Last week under Romans 2, which is the authorship and date of Deuteronomy, a survey of critical purposes, we got down to 2B, number 3. The B is challenges to the classic Wellhausen position from various directions. One was post-exilic, trying to move that 621 date to a later time, post-exilic time. Kenneth Holscher Berry. Number two was advocates of a date earlier than 621, but during the monarchical period. And that was Ewald, Westphal, Oestreicher, Welch, and von Rad. And then three was also pre-monarchical, pushing it earlier, and even earlier than the kingdom period, but not back to the Mosaic period. E. Robertson, R. Brinker both developed a theory that Samuel was basically the one who was behind the compilation material of the Book of Deuteronomy. So that brings us to four advocates of a Mosaic date for Deuteronomy. That certainly is the traditional view, the view that the Bible itself presents to us. I'm not going to do anything other than just mention these names, but what you see there is a sequence of people that span from early 1900s right up to the present. James Orr, the first one, wrote the Old Testament, or the problem of the Old Testament, in 1906. So the problem of the Old Testament, 1906, and argued basically for a Mosaic argument for Deuteronomy. H.M. Wiener wrote two books, one in 1912 and the other in 1920. 1912 was called Pentateuchal Studies, and 1920, the main problem of Deuteronomy. So you see already there, Wiener is focusing in on Deuteronomy as a critical issue, defending a Mosaic origin. J. Ritterboss wrote a commentary on Deuteronomy, two volumes, 1950 and 51. That's written in Dutch. I believe it's recently been translated by Zondervan in that Bible Students Commentary Series. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's the English translation of a Dutch series of commentaries. Most of the Dutch commentaries were written in the 50s, early 60s, and they're gradually producing them in English, and I'm quite sure his has been translated. Just comment about Gay Ritterboss. Gay Ritterboss, the name Ritterboss maybe is familiar to you, primarily from the work of Herman Ritterboss, who was a New Testament professor in Holland, and wrote like An Outline of Paul's Theology, which is a major volume that's been translated, plus some commentaries. Herman Ritterboss was a son of Gay Ritterboss. Gay Ritterboss was a professor of Old Testament. I've mentioned this in some of my other classes. He had two sons. One was N.H. Ritterboss, and the other was H.N. Ritterboss. This is Herman. He was professor of New Testament. That's the one most English people are familiar with, Herman Ritterboss. This is Nico, who was professor of Old Testament. J. Ritterboss was Old Testament. Son Nico was Old Testament. Son Herman was New Testament. But this man, Nico Ritterboss, the man I studied with in college, who's now dead. But in any case, J. Ritterboss, father, defended Mosaic authorship, Deuteronomy. And then about the same time, G.C.H. Albers, also Dutch, wrote an Old Testament introduction, which hasn't been translated into English, but his short introduction to the Pentateuch, as it's called, has been written in English. He defends the Mosaic origin. O.T. Alice, to get to this country, for many years a professor at Princeton, then later of Westminster, the early days of Westminster, wrote the Five Books of Moses. It's a good treatment of Pentateuchal criticism. 1943, you're up into the Second World War era. Then E.J. Young, professor at Westminster Seminary, wrote his Old Testament introduction. First edition was 1949. That was later revised and updated in 1960, who also defended Mosaic origins of Deuteronomy. And more recently, R.K. Harrison, Introduction to the Old Testament, 1969. So my purpose of giving you those names is just to show that over this whole period of a century of time where the Mosaic authorship has been attacked, there have been those that have defended the Mosaic position all along. Yeah.
What are the relative degrees of conservatism in this group of men? I know some of them, like Governor Dallas,
I'd say they're all pretty much the same, although with Alders, he would allow for a few what he terms post-Mosaic, a few phrases here and there, and particularly the end of Deuteronomy with the account of Moses' death, which I don't have any objection to either, that as being appended to the book subsequent to its completion. But he finds a few other phrases here and there that he feels were post-Mosaic, which I'm not sure is necessary. But generally, they're all very conservative.
It's fair to say that this Mosaic authorship of the first five books of the Pentateuch is a very fundamental position in dividing conservative and liberals.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
You don't find any liberals from the Mosaic authorship.
No, not at all. The reverse, you do find some evangelicals going, to some degree or another, towards accepting, to some degree or another, some of this post-Mosaic stuff. Yeah. You see, that's a shame of the thing. If you take the Dutch situation, for example, here was, well, here's a different school. Well, no, I can trace it that way. Three steps. Alders was very strong in Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. He argued against JDP theory, all that kind of thing. He allowed for a few of these post-Mosaic kinds of things. His successor in that chair was Nico Ritterbos, who went a step further and would allow sources in the Pentateuch, maybe some of them. He would feel the Pentateuch was completed probably by the early kingdom period. So you see your... You're not moving down. I mean, he didn't buy the JDP thing wholesale, but he made much more concessions to it than Alders did. The guy in that chair now is a man named Cornelius Houtman. He almost bought the entire thing in modified form, but you could hardly call his view even an evangelical view of Scripture. So, you know, three steps, you've moved from conservative position to totally liberal, three generations of people. And it's the way history seems to go. You start, you know, you open the door this much, and then it goes like that, and it's gone.
Yeah. There are basic fundamental reasons for this. Is it because of the JDP hypothesis, or is it because they couldn't accept that Moses was able to write?
Oh, it gets very... No, I don't think it's the latter. Just gets very involved and very complex. I think there are philosophical things behind it. There are probably intellectual questions of intellectual integrity. They feel here's a problem that hasn't... We don't have an adequate answer, so we have to concede at this point. I don't know. It's hard to explain. To me, it's basic view of Scripture that's behind it, and where you get your view of Scripture. Do you get your view of Scripture from what the Scripture claims for itself, what the attitude of Christ was towards the Old Testament scriptures, which is a deductive process for his method. Do you get it that way, or do you get it inductively? By looking at all these problems, one by one, until you can solve all of them, you don't come to the conclusion that the scripture is reliable. And I think a lot of these men work with that kind of methodology. And they feel, I can't say the scripture is totally reliable because I don't have an answer to this or that problem. And then they feel it's a matter of intellectual integrity. I mean, I wouldn't, even somebody like Kalman, I wouldn't question his integrity. I don't think I would even question his Christianity because I know the fellow. And he's a godly fellow in a lot of ways, but his views of scripture, I think, are totally destructive, ultimately, of what Christianity is based upon. But I think it's because of their way of approach. Oh, I should add to that. It's not on your list. Well, I guess there's a couple more I haven't mentioned, so let me go further. G.T. Manley wrote a book called The Book of the Law, Studies in the Date of Deuteronomy. That's on your bibliography. The Book of the Law, Studies in the Date of Deuteronomy. That was written in 1957. That's over on the last page of your bibliography, I think. No, next to the last, bottom of page 11. I'll come back and make some comments on that book in a minute. But the Book of the Law, Studies in the Date of Deuteronomy, 1957. And then Meredith Klein, or excuse me, B. Holwerda. On page, this is Dutch again. Unfortunately, this hasn't been translated. But page 5, under centralization of worship in Deuteronomy, you see B. Holwerda there, the fourth entry. And the title there in Dutch, the Plaats die de Heere verkiezen zal, is the place that the Lord shall choose. He discusses that phrase in Deuteronomy 12 and the implications of it for this centralization issue, which is at the heart of Wellhausen's theory. And I'll come back to that too later. And then, of course, Meredith Klein, who wrote the Treaty of the Great King. His book is listed on page 4 under Deuteronomy in the Treaty Form. Treaty of the Great King, Covenant Structure of Deuteronomy, Studies and Commentary, 1963. And lastly, I should add to that P.C. Craigie, which is one of the commentaries that you'll read the introduction for this course. That's New International Commentary on the Book of Deuteronomy, published in 1976. He argues for a Mosaic Art. So that's the most recent, detailed, good, solid academic commentary that has argued for this position. Yeah.
J.A. Thompson,
Thompson backs off a Mosaic date.
He speaks about, I've read another commentary on this, about the Deuteronomic principle or Deuteronomic
school,
things like that.
I'll come back and talk a bit about him, but he feels that the final form we presently have of Deuteronomy is post-Mosaic. And I don't quite understand why he comes to that conclusion, but we'll discuss that later, unfortunately. Yeah. McConville. He argues basically for a Mosaic art.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think he's using the terminology for the most part. Now, of those, of that list of people, I'd like to mention four people in that list who are working on different aspects of the Deuteronomy question, but whose work sort of complements each other in confirming a Mosaic origin for the book.
I think it's significant that in the last 25 years, there's been new ground broken, you might say, on this question. So even though it's been debated for a whole century, in the last 25 years, in some cases, like with McConville's book, quite recently, there's been some new work done that tends to confirm and to increase the legitimacy of the argument for a Mosaic origin. And there are four people there whose work together, I think, provides a strong case for reconsideration of this whole JDP theory, and particularly Deuteronomy's place in it. And those four are, first, I'll take them in this order, that Dutchman Holwerda, which is H on your sheet, as I mentioned, he focuses on the issue of centralization of worship as that relates to Wellhausen's theory, and particularly discusses the interpretation of Deuteronomy chapter 12, which is a key chapter for Wellhausen's theory. That's why part of the reason why I wanted you to translate chapter 12 and look rather carefully at chapter 12. We're going to discuss that in class another week or two. Howard addresses that centralization issue. And then secondly, G.T. Manley, in his book, the full title, The Book of the Law, Studies in the Date of Deuteronomy. He handles a number of questions there, including the centralization issue. But he's particularly strong in discussing the alleged developmental relationship between, you know, that J-D, then the D, then the P law code. These three law codes, according to Wellhausen's theory, there's a developmental relationship between them. And what he does is compare the material in what, using again their terminology, what they call J-E, what they call P, and what they call P. He compares that and points up numerous problems with a developmental theory. So, you know, even though on the surface that may sound impressive, Howard Manley points up some problems with that kind of idea in his book. And then thirdly, Meredith Klein. Strength of Meredith Klein, totally different perspective. He works with the literary form of the Book of Deuteronomy. And looks at both its form and content from the perspective of the analogy with particularly the Hittite treaty text, and finds that there's close correspondence between the Hittite treaty text and the structure of the Book of Deuteronomy. The Hittite treaty texts are to be dated approximately to the Mosaic era, certainly not 600. So that I want to go into more detail with you on Klein's position. But what he uses is what you would really call a form-critical analysis to argue for Mosaic origin by finding an extra-biblical analogy in precisely the time that Deuteronomy represents itself to be. I think he makes a good case for that, and I think he has a fairly strong argument. You can't speak in terms of proof. I don't think you can use arguments like that to prove beyond any question Mosaic date or composition of the book, but you certainly can create a model that fits with the data and that supports a Mosaic date. Yes, Mr. Dan.
I don't know when Ben Rod wrote lived this span of life.
Yeah, he died in 61.
And it was in 63 that he wrote this, or was 16?
That who wrote what?
Meredith Klein
wrote. Let me see when that was.
I guess what I'm asking is, did Van Rod ever interact with...
63. Yes, he did interact with Van Rod. I'll come to that too.
Well, why do you vice versa Van Rod interact with Meredith Klein?
Not specifically with Meredith Klein, but Von Rod, you see, Mendenhall's article that first pointed out this analogy, treaty covenant analogy, was 54. And so Von Rod does interact with that, and I'll get to that too. I said 61 for his death. I may have been mistaken on that. May have been a little later than that. pursued. I think it was 71. You see, his commentary in Deuteronomy is 64. That is, von Rotz. He obviously was still alive in 64. I think it was 71 he died. It's comparatively reasonable. But yes, this whole theory, though, of pre-covenant analogy had been developed before von Rotz's death, and Vaderon interacts with it, but doesn't really do justice to it. But we'll come to that. The fourth person is Gordon McConville, the book you're reading. What is that called? Law and Theology in Deuteronomy. Now, basically, in McConville's book, instead of viewing the laws in relation to laws elsewhere in Pentateuch, like this, you know, seeing how D relates to J, E, or how D relates to P, instead of viewing the laws in relation to laws elsewhere in the Pentateuch, McConville focuses primarily on Deuteronomy's laws as uniquely reflecting the theology of Deuteronomy. He says there's a theology behind all these laws. And the laws reflect the theology. The next step in his argument is, he finds the theology to be reflective of the concerns of Israel at the time they were about to enter the Promised Land, which of course then would be the time of Moses, the end of Moses' life. They're in plains of Moab, they're ready to enter the Promised Land. He finds that behind the laws of that, the laws reflect that kind of a situation and a theology that pertains to that situation, about to enter the Promised Land. So you see where what he's getting at is the theology behind the book, which he says fits with the time of Moses. So you see, you get McConville looking at Deuteronomy from that theological perspective. You get Klein looking at it from this sort of form-critical structural perspective. You get Manley looking at the Wellhausen theory and showing problems with this kind of thing. You get Hallward working with the centralization of worship issue. And what I'm saying is, a lot of these recent studies in the book of Deuteronomy sort of complement each other in reconfirming a Mosaic origin. Yeah.
As Hallward, you said his material was not translated. No. Is there any articles that pieces of it that have been?
Not directly of his stuff, but there's, if you look in your bibliography, page 5, I have their centralization of worship in Deuteronomy. That article by Kundal, the second one, Sanctuaries, Central and Local in Pre-Exilic Israel, with particular reference to the book of Deuteronomy. That's a helpful article. And McConville, chapter 2, The Older Law and Centralization of the Cult. And Wenham, another article you're reading, The Date of Deuteronomy, Linchpin of Old Testament Criticism in Thamelios in 85. Those are three helpful articles. I might call your attention at this point to the third entry on page 6, which has just come out, M.J. Paul. Now, again, it's in Dutch. This is a dissertation. You notice 1988, last year. And it's entitled The Archimedean Point of Pentateuchal Criticism. And what he's talking about is Date of Deuteronomy. That whole dissertation is, again, on this. And he's basically arguing for a Mosaic thing. So that's really exciting.
This came out in Dutch, though.
Yeah. I just got a copy about 2 weeks ago, just before this course started. Where were we? All right. I just wanted to call your attention to those four people, particularly. And you're reading Klein and McConville. I'm going to discuss Klein at some length because I think his argument is a crucial one. I'm also going to discuss Hallward. I'm not going to be able to do much with McConville or Manley.
if you're reading McConville, Manly, unfortunately, is out of print, so it's hard to use it, but just call your attention to it. So let's go on to Romans 3 on your outline. That's the covenant form of the book of Deuteronomy and its historical implications. Now, much of what I'm going to say under Romans 3 comes from Meredith Klein's work in his Treaty of the Great King. But A is the structural integrity of the book has often been questioned. Wellhausen said that there was an original core to the book of Deuteronomy, which he said was chapters 12 to 26. But you see, 1 to 11 then, and 27 to 34, he felt were later accretions. The only original core of the book was this, and of course that was late. But what he's saying is that structurally, you don't have a unity in the book. There's an original core of 12 to 26. The rest was later. In other words, later than 621. Klein says, of Adam Welch, W-E-L-C-H, which was one of the men we discussed under Advocates of a Date earlier in 621, but during the monarchical period, Klein says that Welch finds confusion throughout the book, but deems the framework in particular so hopelessly disordered that he declares it misleading to speak of an editor, since that would suggest that a degree of order had been introduced into the chaos. That's Adam C. Welch's estimate of Deuteronomy. Chaotic then, no structural unity or order to it. He doesn't even want to talk about an editor because he thinks that would suggest a degree of order had been introduced that he doesn't find. Another problem often discussed by these critical scholars is what is termed the two introductions for the book. Many of these writers say that Deuteronomy has two introductions. They say that there's one introduction in chapters 1 to 4, and then there's another introduction in chapters 5 to 11. And that it's a redundancy, you might say. Two introductions. G. Ernest Wright, who wrote the commentary on Deuteronomy in the Interpreter's Bible series, pretty standard critical commentary of the 1960s, I believe. Let's see, he's on the first page, I imagine. Yeah, bottom of the first page under commentary. Jonas Wright, Interpreter's Bible, Volume 2. Jonas Wright says, quote, of these two introductions, neither needs the other. They seem independent of each other. And then he adopts a view originally advocated by Martin Noth, that Deuteronomy is really not to be taken as part of the Pentateuch, but it's the first book of what Martin Noth called the Deuteronomistic history. It runs from Deuteronomy to the end of 2 Kings. Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. And the Deuteronomy is the first book of that corpus of material, which he feels was written or edited by one individual in late post-exilic time. But what he says then is that Deuteronomy is the first book of that Deuteronomistic history, and that Deuteronomy 1 to 4 is the introduction to that history as a whole, whereas 5 to 11 is an introduction to the book of Deuteronomy. So that's the way he explains two introductions. But you see, structurally, he says you have two introductions. This is an introduction to the whole Deuteronomic history, Deuteronomistic history. 5 to 11 is just the introduction to the book of Deuteronomy. But I just mentioned some of those things
to point out that the structural integrity of the book's often been questioned. In other words, a lot of these critical scholars come to the book and they don't find a coherent structure to the book.
What is the extent of Deuteronomy?
Deuteronomy, the end of Kings. And of course, the reason why you call that Deuteronomistic history is the theology that's reflected through the historical narratives follows the theology of Deuteronomy. Interestingly enough. And of course, what they're saying is that that kind of theological scheme has been imposed on earlier history because Deuteronomy wasn't around until 621. So, you know, how would you find the theology of Deuteronomy influencing events, say, in the period of the Judges? If the book wasn't written until 621, well, they say the whole period of the Judges has been recast in a way, described in a way that reflects the theology of Deuteronomy. There is very real Deuteronomic influence through all those books. Of course, you put it where it belongs in the Mosaic area, you would expect there to be Deuteronomic influence through all those books.
Is that Noah?
Yeah, Martin Noah. Yeah. All right, B on your sheet. Gerhard von Rod called attention to the significance of Deuteronomy's structural pattern in his Problem of the Hexateuch, 1938. I mentioned that when we were looking at challenges to the Wellhausen position. Von Rod argued for a date earlier in 621, but still in the monarchical period. But the interesting thing is, part of his argument was that he found a structure to the book. And see, that sets him apart from these older critical scholars, or even some of his contemporaries, that found the book chaotic. He called attention to the structure of the book as a whole. In his Problem of the Hexateuch, pages 26 and 27, I think I mentioned this earlier, but he says, obviously, from the point of view of form criticism, no one would accept any such picture of the origins of Deuteronomy. It is precluded by a recognition of the fact that Deuteronomy is in form an organic whole. In form, he says, it's an organic whole. We may distinguish any number of different strata and accretions by literary criteria, but in the matter of form, various constituents form an indivisible unity. The question is thus inescapably raised to the origin purpose of the form of Deuteronomy as we now have it. He says, structurally, the book has four sections. That's in his Problem with the Hexateuch, page 27. He feels that the book structurally reflects chapters 1 to 11, a historical presentation of the events at Sinai, and paranetic material connected with those events. That's 1 to 11. Historical presentation of the events at Sinai and paranetic material connected with these events. Paranetic. You know what that is? Exhortation. Paranesis, paranetic. Deuteronomy has that sort of sermonic quality to it. Exhortation. And then, second section is reading of the law, 12 to 26. 12 to 26 is the legal material. Then he speaks of the sealing of the covenant in 26, 16 to 19. And blessings and curses in Deuteronomy 27 and 12. So, what he concludes is, see, he wants to look at the whole book, form critically. What situation in life would give rise to this kind of form? He finds a form or a structure. And what he says then is, in these four sections, we recognize once again the basic features of what was formerly a cultic ceremony.
manifestly associated with the same festival, which is reflected in the Sinai traditions known to J&E. So the way he looks at it, he sees a structure. He says, form critically, there was some sort of cultic festival that produced this kind of literary form. It's reflected in the book. I'll come back to that view later. But my main reason for calling attention to this is Von Rad at this point goes against the consensus of critical scholars that the book is chaotic. He's saying, no, there is a structure. And that's the structure of the book. Yes?
Isn't that been pointing out a lot of, some of the same things that Hodge would be pointing out?
The different framework, but the methodology has some points of similarity. But different presuppositions, and plugs it in a different way, and so forth. All right, C. Meredith Klein utilized a form critical methodology, honoring the integrity of Scripture, to open a new perspective on the structure of Deuteronomy, which in turn has implications for its interpretation and date. Now, that's all in your outline. Klein utilized a form critical methodology, honoring the integrity of Scripture, to open a new perspective on the structure of Deuteronomy, which in turn has implications for its interpretation and date. What I want to do is, under C, is sort of summarize Klein's argument. So one is statement of his thesis. Statement of Klein's basic thesis. On page 28 of his Treaty of the Great King, he says, the position to be advocated here is that Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document which in its total structure exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. I think that sentence gives you his thesis. The position to be advocated here is that Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document which in its total structure exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. Covenant renewal document which in its total structure, back to that thing of structure, exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. When Klein, let's go on to 2, that's his basic thesis. 2 is Klein's outline of Deuteronomy. When Klein looks at the book, when Klein looks at the book, he breaks it down to 5 parts. First, a preamble, 1:1-5. 2, a historical prologue, covenant history, 1:6-4:49. Thirdly, stipulations, covenant life, 5:1-26:19. That's basically chapter 5 through 26. Now, that breaks into 2 subsections. 5:1-11:32. In other words, 5-11 is the great commandment. The great commandment basically is love the Lord your God, serve Him alone, covenant loyalty, a fundamental obligation of loyalty to the Lord exclusively. B is ancillary commandments. Those are detailed stipulations. That's 12-26. So that's a central core. That's all the laws. And then, fourthly, sanctions, covenant ratification, 27:1-30:20. That's the in that section you get blessings and curses, among other things. And then 31, that should be 31 to 34, 12, that's not 24, 34, is dynastic disposition, covenant continuity, provision for succession to Joshua on Moses' day. Dynastic disposition. So that's the structure that our fine season book. Number three. Yes. You mean Klein's basic thesis? Yes, it has. I'll come to that later. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the article that I asked you to read by K.A. Kitchen, which is really a review of this book by Nicholson. Nicholson rejects the whole analogy, and Kitchen, I think, shows that Nicholson's rejection is unwarranted. Three is standard elements of the Hittite treaty text. We talk about this analogy between the treaty text and the structure of the book of Deuteronomy. Well, what's the structure of the treaty text? And everybody's pretty much agreed, if you look at these Hittite treaties, there are 20 some of them. They pretty regularly follow this kind of a structure. Five elements. One, a preamble. Introduces the great king, gives his name, his titles, that kind of thing. Two, historical prologue, which summarizes previous history of relationship between the great king and his vassal. Three is stipulations. These are the obligations that are placed on the vassal. They're placed on the vassal out of a sense of obligation to the great king, because the great king has done certain things for the vassal, therefore he has reason to expect that the vassal will do these things. Those stipulations can be divided into two types, a basic stipulation and detailed stipulation. Basic stipulation is that fundamental obligation of loyalty. And the detailed ones spell out all kinds of specific things that the great king expects. Sometimes, not in all the texts, but in some of them you have included there provision of deposit of a copy of the treaty text in the sanctuary of the vassal. And sometimes you have provision for periodic deposit of a copy of the treaty text in the sanctuary of the vassal. And sometimes you have provision for periodic reading, that that text is then to be read to the people on certain occasions, periodically. Which finds a parallel in the Mosaic deposit of the copy of the law in the tabernacle and the reading of it on the occasion of the Feast of Tabernacles. But then witnesses, number four, and number five, curses and blessings. Witnesses are the gods who witness the agreement. And the curses and blessings are the things that these gods will ensure happen if the vassal is either obedient or the blessed is disobedient and will be cursed.
Yes.
Now,
I think that one copy of the Jewish
text by the Sumerian
and
the other copy of the text by the
Baptist.
That's right.
Then
what
do you think of J. Thompson's suggestion that Moses wrote it on two tablets, the two tablets are identical, and both of them were kept by Israel?
How was it?
People
is not incompatible with the book's own representation of itself as consisting of a series of addresses of Moses. See, some of the attention, this is a covenant. This is a document that reflects the treaty. How do you harmonize that with the way the book presents itself as a series of addresses of Moses to the people? What Klein says on page 29 is the treaty document was the libretto of the covenant ceremony. The libretto, like the words to a musical composition. The libretto of the covenant ceremony, sometimes including the response of the vassal as well as the declarations of the suzerain. When, therefore, we identify Deuteronomy as a treaty text, we are also recognizing it as the ceremonial words of Moses. The customary conception of these Mosaic addresses as a freely ordered farewell must be so far modified as to recognize that their formal structure closely followed fixed ceremonial legal traditions, though they are certainly no stereotyped liturgical recital, nor the dispassionate product of an imperial foreign office. In other words, what he's saying is the book reflects a covenant renewal ceremony, and the setting is Moses in the plains of Moab leading the people through this renewal of allegiance to the Lord. So, understanding it as a covenant renewal document is not incompatible with the book's own representation consisting of a series of addresses of Moses. 5, there's a formal similarity here with von Rad's approach. But, as far as difference, von Rad does not honor the integrity of the book as it represents it. He has a highly theoretical cultic derivation theory. What he means by that is, I've touched on that in the last class, he feels that there was a cultic ceremony held at Shechem under Joshua, and the traditions of that ceremony were carried through the years and the generations by the Levites, and that there were periodic covenant renewal events from which the form of Deuteronomy was devised fairly late. You know, he says not more than a century before 621. So that he feels that Shechem ceremony, the ritual of it, and the ideas of it were preserved by the Levites, and eventually the book of Deuteronomy's structure was derived from that. So both Klein and von Rad are using what you might call form critical methodology to look at the structure of the book. But Klein's doing it in a way that honors the integrity of the text. Von Rad is not. Let's take a 10-minute break. But we started at 2, and we're 5 minutes old. So let's take a 10-minute break.
Page related to number 4.
Page 29.
Number 4.
I think we were down to number 6. I commented on 5. 6 is Deuteronomy begins as the ancient treaties did. On page 30 of he says, Deuteronomy begins precisely as the ancient treaties began. These are the words of. Those are the first words in the book of Deuteronomy. These are the words of. The Jewish custom of using the opening words of a book as a title turns out in the present case to be most felicitous, for it serves to identify this book at once as a treaty document. Deuteronomy 1:1-5 then goes
on to identify the speaker of the words as Moses, one who receives divine revelation, communicates the sovereign will of the Lord to Israel. Yahweh is therefore the suzerain who gives the covenant. Moses is his vice-regent and the covenant mediator. This section thus corresponds to the preamble of the extra-biblical treaty. The preamble of the extra-biblical treaty, the great king is identified, the superior part. So this section corresponds to the preamble of the extra-biblical treaty, which also identifies the speaker, the one who by the covenant was declaring his lordship and claiming the last of Israel.
Well, if you go down to verse 3, Moses proclaimed to the Israelites all that the Lord had commanded him concerning them. Okay? So I think Klein's idea is that Moses is the speaker, but he is the vice regent. The Lord is the speaker. The Lord is the speaker. All right. I think what Klein means when he says these are the words, then he has dot, 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 it goes on. But the point is, the words that have been spoken are really the Lord's words to Moses as the presenter. All right, number 7. Klein's approach to Deuteronomy solves the two introduction problems. He says on page 30, the bottom of the page, a major problem concerning the unit of Deuteronomy has been the presence of the quote, two introductions, chapters 1 to 4 and 5 to 11. He discusses that a bit. He discusses notes to you that I mentioned here. Now, this is the introduction to the pretty much a history, but this is the Deuteronomy itself. And Klein says, notes view in every attempt to separate Deuteronomy 1 to 4 from the original 4 is contradicted. The supposed problem of the two introductions is obviated, and the real structure of Deuteronomy is further clarified by these facts. An historical prologue regularly follows the preamble and precedes the stipulations of the decision of the treaty. In Deuteronomy 1-5 through 449, qualifies admirably as such an historical prologue. See, here's the historical prologue. Now, it says here 1-5, elsewhere it says 1-6. But from 1-6 through 449, you have a historical prologue. So that's what 1-4 is. 5 to 11, you see, in time. So that's 5:1-11, the great commandment that follows the treaty structure, the basic stipulation. So what Klein is saying is that allegedly two introduction from the solve by this understanding. Okay? Chapters 5 to 26 correspond to the stipulation section of the treaty. It says the third division of Susan's treaties, bottom of 31, top of 32, was the stipulations, and this division, Deuteronomy, can readily be identified with chapters 5 to 26. Von Rod has noted above, including chapters 5 to 11, with 1 to 4 as a paranetic historical survey. Others, separating 5 to 11 from 1 to 4, regard them as an introduction to chapters 12 to 26. But Deuteronomy 5 to 11 must be recognized as expounding the covenant way of life, just as do chapters 12 to 26. Together, they declare the suzerain's demands, the basic obligations and detailed obligations. The differences between Deuteronomy 5:11, 12 to 26 only represent differing treatments of this one theme.
former section presents in more general and comprehensive terms the primary demand of the consecration of the Lord. Both in principle six and program seven, the latter adds the more specific ancillary requirements. Says later, bottom of page 32, the portatory character of the Deuteronomic stipulation, even of those in 12 to 26, even when you're here with these commandments, you get this sort of sermonic kind of style. And it says that portatory character of the Deuteronomic stipulation, even of those in 12 to 26, exposes the inaccuracy of speaking of a Deuteronomic author. In some rigid stylistic way, he says this feature is not without, but this feature is not without parallel in the formulation of the treaty stipulation. In some treaty texts, you get that portatory kind of form of the obligation based on the vassal. He says we're reminded of Moses recalling the lessons of Israel's past history when Marcellus, who is a Hittite grand king, when Marcellus enforces his demand for 300 shekels of gold by exhorting Duffy Tester, do not turn your eyes to anyone else. Do not turn your eyes to anyone else. Your fathers presented tribute to Egypt. You shall not do that. He says this documentary feature would be naturally fully exploited by Moses in conducting the renewal ceremony, which was also a personal farewell. And then he says, it's then unnecessary in a misguided effort when Bonrad seeks to account for the interspersion of commandments with paranesis in terms of later Levitical preaching of the law of the cultural festivals, to that oratory character. Modulated to this political preservation interest. Fine, so this time to do that, it's what we characteristic of the treaty text in first place. And that's just a part of what's particularly being lawful as well. Well, you may notice when you read the Kitchen, that article when he reviews Nicholson's written book, Nicholson tests the whole analogy. But Kitchen argues that Deuteronomy in its form is sort of a fusion of the Hittite treaty form with the ancient Near Eastern law code form. In other words, he finds elements of the law code format as well as elements of the treaty format. And what he feels is what Moses has done is drawn from both in sort of that way. Unique form that is a fusion of the two forms. It's an interesting idea. You may be onto that. No. It's not a rigid, you look at Deuteronomy, which I think that it's not a rigid, stereotype kind of copy. It's not the same general structure, same kind of terminology. But it's loose. And I think Kitchen points out, you find some elements of law codes as well. And the, you know, the well favored. I'm not sure. I have to look at some of these things. Oh, okay, I don't recall how it does now. I think it probably will. You get this alternation between the two floral views. What was that? Number eight. Well, Also, I should say under that number 8, which is 5 to 26, which is corresponding to the stipulation section of the treaties. When treaties were updated, the customary to modify the requirement was updated. And get rid of this structure. But what's the relationship to Deuteronomy to the kind of people living there? The covenant was enacted in Sinai, Moses. And knew the generation later. Do get some differences. Probably the most well known difference is what the Sabbath is.
Deuteronomy 5. And that's the commandment. Yeah, you see, if you compare the Sabbath commandment, Deuteronomy 5, say verse 15, with Exodus 20, verse 11. Verse 15 of Deuteronomy 5 says, remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord has commanded you to observe the Sabbath. So that it's based in that deliverance out of Egypt, that generation of Egypt experience. Whereas in Exodus 20, the Sabbath commandment is based in the 6 days of creation. Exodus 20, verse 4, in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, and he rested the seventh. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. Now, why is there a conflict between Sabbath and Exodus 2, one, you say it's a conflict? Why is there a difference? I think it's, you can say it's an update. This is a generation that's just experienced it. Updating was characteristic of renewal of treaty. It seems to me that this law, as well as others, you see modification, which you can do effectively. Alright, 27 to 30, that's number 9. Deuteronomy 27 to 30 follows the standard form of the treaties in presenting sanctions and means for covenant ratification. The usual thing is, John 26, you have added material that's not part of the original core of the book. Appendixes. To say that disregards the structural continuity of the treaty pattern. Because in 27 to 30, you have the first blessing sanction of the government, which was a standard feature of the treaty text. Here's the way here's the way 27 to 30 breaks down and finds a more detailed outline. 27:1-26, you have a ratification ceremony in Canaan. When you get into Canaan, you're to go to Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, and built an altar there, right out the wall. And you have that ratification ceremony then in Canaan, 27:1-26. Then blessings and curses in 28. Summons the covenant oath, 29. Ultimate restoration, radical decision, in 30. 1-10 and 11-20. By the way, those are the two passages on this. So, again, that fits well with the structural integrity of the book, based on that treaty analysis. That's number 9. 10:31-34 take on great significance as integral features of covenant doctrine rather than miscellaneous appendixes. Thirty-one to 34, in a more detailed way, include final arrangements, 31:1-29, Song of Witness. Witnesses were a structural feature of the treaty text. You get a Song of Witness in 31:30-32:47. Difference, of course, difference. The Hittite text is the gods with the two partners. In Israel, you don't have a polytheistic sort of notion, but you have this Song of Witness, days to come. You depart. This is what's going to happen to you. And that's an important part of the book, an important part of the structure. Then Moses' Testament, 32:48-33:29. He pronounces his blessings on the tribe. And dynastic succession, 34:1-12, succession from Moses to Joshua, which is really the occasion for the whole renewal ceremony. You have the transition to leadership in place. Treaties were renewed at the point of dynastic succession. And here is precisely that. Moses is departing. Who is going to pick up the mantle and keep covenant continuity going forward? So again, not the good. Structural ideas that are important to the integrity of the whole
discussion. At this point in your day, Mr. Witness, you see a little bit of adaptation from the catch.
Yes.
Has anybody related that theology, the book, that the reason for the conversion?
Well, I don't know if anybody's done that in detail.